This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Good afternoon, Joy listeners. It is Sunday afternoon, and it is Sunday Arts Magazine with David and Brendan.
Hello, Brendan.
Hello, David Hunt.
White night last night.
White night last night, / this morning for you.
Yes, the last 2 years I have gone during the night, and the crowds have been out of control, which that's what it, and it would, you know, be disappointing if it wasn't. Mm. But the good thing is they have spread it out a lot more this year, haven't they? But I decided to do it from the back end. So I got up at 4 o'clock and came in and saw the end, and with the sunrise coming over the city. And one of the last things I did was along the Yarra, the most beautiful water day. What are they called? Water flowers.
Yeah. They were called Sita's Garden.
Yeah. And they were these beautiful water lilies. That's what they were. And they were lit up and they would change colours very subtly. Mm. There was about 5 of them. They were huge.
Absolutely huge.
And they're inflatable, but they just look so beautiful. And the music, and there was a barge floating along behind it. And when I saw it, I saw a photo in today's paper that it was actually Bollywood dancers at one stage. Mm. But there were girls chanting about love, and because it was sunrise, and the sunrise was coming over the city, and they had all bird noises with the music that they was playing. It was one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen in my life.
And it'd be a different way to see Melbourne as well, especially that time of the morning, and such a special event.
Yeah. It was very, very special, and I felt very moved by it. It was great. And then down at the NGV, on my way in, because the tram stopped there, it was incredible. The Moat, they had all these break dancers with some of the best music I've ever heard. And I believe they were French, a French company that did it. It was really good. I've never seen so many photographers in my life, not people with their phones, but photographers taking shots of it, because it was so good. And then inside the NGV, of course, there was interesting things happening and stuff. So I was absolutely delighted on the stuff. The dragon on the hill, spitting out a fire, was pretty spectacular as sunrise was coming as well. So I saw it very differently. And what I saw also was a lot of people, about 45 onwards, that had gotten up early to come in. A lot of people walking their dogs. Oh, there was also in Alexander Gardens, there was all these spinning wheels that were creating all this amazing music, and people were laying down, and it was just... this electronic music was spectacular.
Yeah,
it was really, really good. But it was a different sort of crowd. You know, like, of course, there were the hangers-on that had been around all night and a little bit messy, but not too bad.
No.
And then also a lot of families, parents with their 10-year-old kids, and what a great experience for these kids to have gotten up early in the morning to come in. And lots of people on bikes, push bikes, riding, because it was so far away from each other.
That would have been a great way to see it, to be honest. But I came in at about 10 o'clock, 10:30, and seeing the sort of young people getting involved in, you know, such an artistic thing, I think it's great, whether they come that night or in the morning with their parents. Like, I just think it's great to get people talking, because it is, it's such a social event. People are talking, taking photos.
And I love the way that a lot of people dress up as well.
with
some of the most crazy outfits. And you know, like, they became part of the White Night as well, which I thought was really lovely to see.
Yeah, well, and I was lucky, there's been exhibitions on the last, we've interviewed people that have been curating them, but it's hard to go get to see all these things. And most of those were open during the night. So I got to see Bohemian Melbourne, finally, and Experimental Recharge, who we had on a little while ago as well. Yep. And that was just fantastic. And once again, it was just very, very social and got people talking about it, talk about art and, you know, what their reaction is to it, because it is very, a lot of it is, you know, very modern, you know, cross-media kind of things. So it's very immediate. People sort of have an immediate reaction to it. They want to tell their friends. It's fantastic.
And I think it was different enough this year as well. It seemed very different what was going on this year than last year. And it would be interesting, because I read in today's paper that the new premier, and it's a Labor Party now, and it was the Liberals that actually bought White Night to Melbourne. And it obviously must cost the government an absolute fortune, and he's now saying, oh, it's not the time to talk about it, this is wonderful what's going on in Melbourne, but we will be talking about it, and whether we're actually, because it was only a 3-year contract with White Knight, because it's from France, and it's in 7 countries around the world now, and I think it would be sad if we did lose it, but I can understand because of the cost, but the amount of people that engage with it is really important for the city of Melbourne anyway.
Yeah, maybe some brainstorming would work if how to sort of raise a bit more money to pay for it and work out the sort of that side, the business side of things to make sure it does happen again.
There aren't sponsors involved. I suppose maybe that's what they should do, is get sponsors involved, because it is, you know, like, that's the idea of it as well, is it's actually run by the local government. So it's hard to
pull off sometimes. So.
It really is, you know, the cost of things like that. But a wonderful night in Melbourne. I know a lot of people have got burnt by it over the last 2 years because the crowds were so huge. But you've got to remember, this is the most wonderful art form, and it was free here for one night.
Exactly. Now, we're going to get into a song. This is Robbie Williams.
I'm a big fan. not somebody that we'd normally play on Sunday Arts Magazine.
Not his normal repertoire, but this comes from his first Swing album, right. Swing When You're Winning.
Yep.
And I thought this was a very fitting song for today, because after this, we're going to get into the Oscar wrap-up.
Right.
And what's give all my song? Predictions. This one's called I Will Talk and Hollywood Will Listen.
Well, can we just talk about it before? I have seen, and I'm a big fan of these two Swing albums that he's done. I saw the from Royal Albert Hall when he did the DVD for this particular album. It was probably 6 or 7 years ago, if not longer. And this song he wrote himself, and it's saying that, you know, he should be a big Hollywood star, but Mr. Spielberg, why don't you listen and make me a star? And the crowd would go crazy each time he spoke about it. He is such a good songwriter, and it comes out in this song, and it's a very powerful, emotional song, and he sang it just so beautifully in that live concert.
We certainly did. Now, this is Robbie Williams on Sunday Arts Magazine with Brendan and David.
Joy 94.9.
Little absurd, bow at my every word.
You are on Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy. And that was Robbie Williams. What a fantastic track that was.
Awesome.
And what a great setup to our next segment, which is
your predictions for the Academy Awards.
Yes. Now, I'm not going to give away the big ones yet.
Right.
I might work backwards a little bit.
Okay.
Now, this one has gotten a little bit of attention, the original screenplay, because it features Nightcrawler, which didn't get any nominations for any other categories. But that was, I think you remember, it was one of my favourites, basically, of the year.
Yeah.
A definite 5-star kind of film. And it kind of got snubbed, you know, during the whole Best Picture sort of discussions and stuff like that. So I am really rooting for this one, for the original screenplay, and it's just won the award for another event. So I think it's on a bit of a roll. So I think that might be a good one.
Oh, right.
Now, you haven't seen that film, have you?
No, I haven't. No.
Well, you definitely have to get onto it. Now, in terms of visual effects, Guardians of the Galaxy is a standout to me, a Marvel production, and I think that one will take it away.
Right.
yes, a fantastic film. Like, in terms of entertainment value, I've kind of talked about it a lot. I think you might have been away when I saw it, actually.
Right.
When you're in
New York.
But it's, yeah, it was a strong film, but obviously kind of gets overlooked in the other categories. But in terms of visual effects, just seamless. James Gunn did a fantastic job with his visual effects crew. Now, going on to sound mixing. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the difference between sound mixing and sound editing is, but I'll pick the one that really did stand out to me, Whiplash. I think that will take away the sound mixing Oscar.
Mm.
Just the way that the images and the sound were put together, it was electric. It was really, really amazing. They must have obviously worked very, very hard with the actual film editor just to get it on point, because it's Miles Teller plays this sort of ingenue drummer.
That's right.
And he didn't know how to play drums, really. So they had to kind of fake it and to get it at least looking, you know,
as if he knew what he was doing.
Exactly. Yeah, and get the beats right. And we're talking about, you know, really high speed drumming. I think they did an amazing job. And I think it would be a crime if it didn't take home the award for sound
and
mixing.
And again, another one, film that a lot of people have really liked, but it gets overlooked because there are so many others in front of it.
Exactly, unfortunately. But it could be a dark horse, maybe. But I think it, we'll get to the other award that I think it will take home in a little bit. Now, production design, we can talk about this a fair bit. I think Grand Budapest Hotel will take home the award for that.
Of course. I can't see anything coming close to it, really.
No.
Because visually, it was just amazing.
Just incredible. Just down to the finest detail. And I remember us talking about it at one other show, about even down to the detail of the treat boxes, the beautiful green delicacies from the bakery.
Yep.
Just, you know, you could just feel it. It's
been a long time since I've seen a film that the detail was that good.
Yeah.
And the sense of humour with it as well was so, so clever.
It was very... it was probably the most comedic I've seen him go. And that's why I think I really launched onto that one more than the Darjeeling Limited and a few of the other ones from the past. Yeah, I think that was a standout. Now, this one... the next award is the Achievement in Music. This one's a little bit of an interesting one. It's for original Best Original Song, essentially.
Yep.
And I think this is... It's a great song. It's Glory from the Selma soundtrack.
Right.
Really great song, but I think because it has been so hardly done by in the other categories, I think there's a good chance it'll take this one home.
Okay.
Which...
And who sings it? Is it John Legend sings it?
Well, it's music and lyrics by John Stevens and Lonnie Lynn.
Right.
I'm not 100% sure.
I thought that he did do the song in that, but maybe not, because I couldn't imagine he would have written it, wouldn't he? But
well,
maybe
he usually does, yeah.
Yeah, maybe because it's Academy Award, they went with better-known songwriters in that category. But they got him to actually do the vocals, but I could be wrong.
Yes. And speaking of music, we'll go back to Achievement of Music written for Motion Pictures' original score. So rather than a song, the actual score, the complete score, you can't go past... Grand Budapest Hotel again. Uh-huh. I think this one by Alexander Desplat, it's just a standout. It just brings the whole comical and whimsical elements together.
Yeah, and that's what was so good about it. The music was so comical at times as well, but also very lush and so beautiful, stunning.
Just absolutely stunning, yes. Now, I won't go through every category, because you probably get a little bit bored out there, but the next major one was sound editing, which is very important. And this one was a standout because I think Birdman really took the cake for that one as well. We'll get to Birdman in a little bit. but in terms of Best Picture, we're going to get straight into it, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Right. Okay. Big call.
Now, we talked about this a little bit earlier, and we've talked about this film a lot, but it really is a standout. Mind you, this list that I've put together, it's sort of a cross between what I think will win and what I think should win.
Right.
So I'm definitely leaning towards should win for this one, but there could be an upset with Boyhood on this one.
Yeah, it's won a lot, hasn't it, Boyhood? But I think in this category, probably the Grand Budapest will, should
get
up there. And a lot of the other critics around town and internationally have been saying it's Budapest's year.
And speaking about Whiplash earlier, J.K. Simmons, I think he's a lock-in to win Best Supporting Actor.
Right.
But in terms of the supporting role for an actress in a film, Patricia Arquette, she's got that one locked in as well.
Okay.
So I think that one's a given. Some of the main ones, they're kind of, you know, they've been getting the same award, or sorry, all the awards for the same films, essentially. Mm. So I think they're pretty safe bet, especially Julianne Moore for Still Alice, which we spoke about, I think, last week or the week before. But this other one, so our last category for this segment is performance of an actor in a leading role. Now, this one could go a few different ways because Eddie Redmayne has got some form in terms of winning some of the bigger awards leading up to the Oscars. But I do think Michael Keaton will take that away.
Everyone's been saying that. I haven't seen the film, but everyone's saying it.
It's funny. Birdman's getting had all these parodies done of it this week.
Mm.
Big Birdman.
Yeah.
So I think hopefully that might actually help a little bit just to sort of make it part of the popular vernacular. Now let's get into another song. This is, I'll get my notes. Cloud Control. It's called Moon Rabbit, and I love this little track. You're listening to Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
You are on Sunday Arts Magazine. If you do want to become part of the conversation, 0427 Joy 949 is our SMS, or you can phone 1300 Joy 949, or you can email onair@joy.org.au. Now, thanks for sticking around, David.
Oh,
I love saying that to you. Now, we've got a guest on the phone. Tell us a little bit about him.
Okay, well, I'm very privileged to have him on the phone, actually. He's from the most amazing orchestra and chorus and choir here in Australia, the Brandenburg. And Nick Gilbert, he's a baritone with him. Nick, are you on the phone?
I am indeed.
And welcome to Joy.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about this amazing show you're bringing to Melbourne.
Absolutely. So, look, we're bringing a program entirely composed by George Frideric Handel down in Melbourne on the 7th and the 8th. And so it's a series of music that Paul Dyer and our guest artists have decided on. And the core of it is a piece called The Ode to Saint Cecilia, which is about a 50-minute piece, and we break over interval in the middle of it to give you a chance to really soak it all up. But it's really incredible music from Handel from sort of 18th century London.
And it's called Heaven and Harmony?
That's right, Handel, Heaven, Harmony.
Yes. And what's your background? How long have you been with them?
So I've been performing at the Brandenburg since about 2012. One of my friends put me forwards for an audition, and it was an audition with Paul Dyer, and it was just such an incredible opportunity auditioning with him. It was a really, really interesting audition, and it kind of set the tone, I think, the last 3 or 4 years. And I've done every OLL with Brandenburg since then, which is the big Christmas concert series that we bring to Melbourne every year. And it's just a beautiful group to be a part of.
Right.
And obviously, I've been singing all of my life. Singing as part of this incredible group of singers and performers, just incredible opportunity and a great group to be part of.
Right. And when you said interesting, what happened?
Well, I think the wonderful thing about Brandenburg is that it's not just about the music itself. It's also this group of people that get on incredibly well together, that all bring their own personalities into the mix. And in that sort of the melting pot of those personalities and the virtuosic nature of a lot of the players, that's where a lot of the magic comes out of. So I felt like it was as much a psychiatric test as much as it was an audition.
Right.
And to some extent, you know, it was. He was to suss out, what's my sense of humor like? How am I going to fit into the group? And if you've ever seen Paul perform, what he's like on stage is exactly what he's like when he's auditioning you or when he's rehearsing with you. So
yeah, there's so much passion there. Paul. Yeah, there's so much passion there with Paul, isn't there?
Exactly right. And that was so obvious from the beginning. And that's why, you know, you go to an audition like that and you go, absolutely, this is a group I want to be a part of.
Right. It also is a case that, yeah, like Paul is so involved with the whole look. You know, I believe he even designs the amazing clothes you guys wear.
So he's, I think he's just come off, I think it's been announced on the Facebook. So he's just worked with MJ Bale to arrange for all of the orchestra, not the choir, unfortunately, but all of the orchestra to be individually dressed by MJ Bale. So lots and lots of sort of creative artistry that's gone into that. And I think you'll find it pretty interesting the first time you see us on the stage. Certainly exciting.
Yeah.
Definitely interesting.
Yeah, and what is it like for you? There's the orchestra and then there's the choir. How integral are the two together?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think that one of the interesting things about the Baroque music that we perform, that to a large extent, a lot of the time, the choir is almost behaving like an instrument, and very different to what you might experience if you were doing musical theatre or if you're going to see a more modern piece. So we need to intermesh sort of intimately, and so we obviously know the instrumentalists really, really well. But I think the nature of the music lends itself towards this really kind of intermingling of the different parts, quite different to, you know, I do musical theatre as well. You're up on the stage with a mic, and the band is in the pit. You don't feel connected except through the musical director.
Yep.
Whereas with Australian Brandenburg, you're right there. They're right in front of you. You're making eye contact, and you're making music together, which is great.
Right, because it's not with every performance that they actually use the choir, is it?
No, not at all. And that, I think, reflects the repertoire. There is a lot of just instrumental music, which, you know, the choir doesn't get a Guernsey. And while as a singer, I'd love it all to be all about the basses, but it's not always the case.
And that's what makes it that little bit special when all of a sudden the choir's brought in with the orchestra, isn't it?
I think so. It's also really exciting when you're in the middle of a concert where you've got both the choir and the orchestra on stage. You move to something that's just a cappella with a choir or something that just has the orchestra. And it gives that vibrancy and it allows you to create a contrast inside an actual performance.
Right. And there are a couple of special guests.
There are indeed. So we've got we have two incredible up and coming singers. We've got Mariana Flores, who is a soprano from Argentina, who just has the most divine and sensual voice. And then there's Fernando Guimaraes, who is an incredibly powerful and strong tenor. He's also, I understand, got quite a bit of actor in him. So that will be really exciting on stage. We haven't actually had a chance to rehearse with him. That's coming on Tuesday.
Right,
really,
okay.
Very much looking forward to it.
All right. Well, it sounds absolutely brilliant, and I can't wait to come along and see you at Recital Centre on Saturday the 7th of March, and that's at 7 p.m, and then you're repeating on the Sunday the 8th at 5 p.m. Right. Thank you so much, Nick, for taking some time out because you guys are obviously very busy. And one day when you're in Melbourne, you've got some extra time, come to the station. We'd love to have a chat with you.
A small group of singers to come and sing for you, maybe.
That sounds very nice.
Really?
Thank you so much for being on. Okay.
Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye. Wow, what an amazing group of people they are. And they're so talented. And I can't believe how good they are. Brandenburg Concerto and Orchestra are coming to Melbourne soon.
Just wonderful. You're listening to Sunday Arts Magazine with David and Brendan.
Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine with Brendan Michael Bale and David John Hunt.
David John Hunt.
Now, we are absolutely delighted to have in the studio director extraordinaire. Well, you know, like build him up and then chop him down. Wayne Harris. Wayne, welcome.
Thanks, David.
Now, you're part of a new play, which I can't wait to talk to you about, called Young and Jackson.
That's
but
right.
We'll get to that a little bit later. Let's talk about you as the director. And a bit of your background, because you've done millions of things, haven't you?
I feel very old, yes.
Well, you were CEO and artistic director of the Sydney Theatre Company.
Yes.
You also was creative director of Sydney New Year's Eve, which is a huge celebration in Sydney. The closing ceremony of the Melbourne Commonwealth Games. I was part of that, actually.
Oh my God.
And you bossed me around and I cried. No, I didn't. And you've also been involved with Tap Dogs. Oh, look, it just goes on and on and on. Yeah, like you've really done some big things, haven't you?
I have, yes. I've had a lot of good breaks and a lot of enjoyment along the way, and thankfully quite a bit of success, which has been very rewarding.
Right. Now, where did the interest come from back when you were starting out in this business?
Oh, I was a child performer here in Melbourne. My mother was a soubrette at the Tivoli, just down the road.
Oh, okay.
From here and what's left of it now.
A terrible arcade.
Not much, but I remember seeing her on stage there with George Wallace Jr. when I was a, I don't know, 4-year-old or something like that. And so she encouraged me to be I was a tap dancer. I was not a bad hoofer, actually. And much to my father's chagrin, he didn't quite like it. He was a jockey, so he would. So I spent most of my youth either at a race course or in a theatre.
Right. Okay.
But I grew to such proportions that I had to give up any pretensions to riding, to being a hoop, and the theatre won out, and I ended up being a kind of performer for J.C. Williamson's as a teenager and then into the early 20s.
Now, that would have been fascinating.
Oh, it was. It was kind of... I owe most of my career or success to a woman called Betty Pounder, who was kind of the engine and a lot of the inspiration behind J.C. Williamson's in the last years of the empire before it crumbled completely in the 70s. And she kind of took control of my career and steered it for a while and then told me that I was good but not good enough, that I should go to university and maybe I'd end up giving them all jobs. So I took her word and her advice and went to university and kind of became a dramaturg and then a director and then an artistic director, and now I'm here with you.
Right, because just recently as well, you know, a Spiegelworld.
Yes.
Which we know Empire and the new one's coming, which you've been involved in as well.
Absinthe, yes. Yeah. Yes, I tend to direct all of Spiegelworld's North American productions. I did Empire in New York. And
which I love. The twice I've seen it here in Melbourne's been just wonderful. The two main characters, that the banana routine that they do, the juggling act, is absolutely hysterical.
Yes. When I first saw them do that in Chicago, I was kind of knocked out by it and said, yeah, well, we have to kind of get that into one of our shows. And we did. Absinthe has been running in Las Vegas now for 4 years. It's about to go into its fifth year. It's been a huge success. And so the idea arose that maybe it could be cloned and sent on a world tour.
And when you do that, when you're making those creative decisions, is it very dependent on where you're taking it as to how it may evolve, or do you keep things quite the same all around the world?
Oh, it's a... as a creative process, it varies. Usually what we will do is scour the world and like go to Chicago and see these two comedians do funny things like the banana spitting routine. And the two comedians in Absinthe are exceptional as well. And you gather around you a collection of acts and talents. And then put a few ideas in, and then I sort of sit down and kind of write the stories or the scenario about what the show will be. So it kind of varies. Each show is different, and the one in Vegas has kind of clicked and is seen as the naughty kid on the block there. It's kind of, and we're known as anti-Cirque.
Yeah, because it's very different to what you would expect to see in Vegas, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it takes that Cirque template and turns it on its head.
Absolutely.
On its head slightly, yeah. And offends quite a few people, but it has pleasured quite a few others and made it, as I said, into a show that's been running for 4 years now.
Right. Tell us about this new show, 45 Downstairs.
Yes, great space.
Yes, great space. And about a hotel here that's legendary, Young and Jackson's.
And yes, and the people who run Y&J's have been fantastic to us and welcoming us and kind of giving us the history of the place. But most of the key scenes in the play are actually set in a room on the first floor of Young and Jackson's, as a couple of Navy boys in 1945, the last months of the Second World War, kind of hang out there and meet a young girl who's going to change their lives.
Right. Because it was a famous place. I was telling Brendan, because Brendan's not originally from Melbourne, about how all the troops would have a drink there and salute that famous painting that's up on the first floor.
Yes.
Before they would then get on the train at Flinders Street Station and go off to war.
Yes, it was quite a ritual.
Yeah.
But it was also, it's kind of mentioned in the play too. It was I remember my father taking me there when I was 12 or something like that and spiriting us into the bar to show us Chloe, and it was kind of like a coming of age ritual. Mm. And famously during Second World War there was a brawl in the bar where somebody threw a glass at Chloe and caused a bit of damage that she had to be repaired.
Right. I'm sure that would have happened a lot in that pub.
Yes.
But it's still wonderful today that it's there, and it's a tourist attraction in itself, isn't it?
It is. We were there the other night when about 25 Germans came through and had the whole history of Chloe and the bar explained to them, and how she was part of a much larger art collection that was kind of sold off over the years, mainly during the Great Depression when money was kind of tight.
Yeah. So give us a bit of a rundown on this play.
It's about three young sailors in Melbourne.
Yep.
The play Younger Jackson is actually a prequel to another play called Codgers, also written by the late Don Reed. And that play, Codgers, was based on his experience of hanging out with six old men in a gym every Wednesday. And he kind of got to know their prejudices and their peccadillos, and Codgers is a play which kind of just confronts their racism and their opposition to cross-dressing. So when we were making a movie of Codgers, which we did, we made a feature film a couple of years ago, we had the idea that maybe a prequel would be interesting, to actually go back and see the origins of their prejudices. And that's, I said to Don, if you write the play, I will produce it and direct it. And that's what's happening, even though, unfortunately, he died a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
We're here. It seems like a Melbourne story to us. So we decided to come to Melbourne and produce this play about these young guys.
And is controversy a part of this one as well?
It's a little controversial. It's a bit confronting when you actually see the origins of their opinions and their prejudices. But they're only half the story. There's another half of the story that kind of counters that and sees how they might change over the years.
So this is the world premiere of this play?
It is, indeed.
Right. And how do you feel Melbourne audiences will take to it?
Oh, well, I'm hoping that that they'll take like ducks to water to it. I mean, it's funny and the characters are engaging and the young cast are fantastic. So I don't know, but it is a play written by a man in his late 70s and 80s. He was 80, I think, when he wrote the play. And that, so it's we call it a new play about old ways, in that it actually references a version of Australia that is not necessarily current.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit of old-fashioned storytelling, but I hope I'm using the space in a very unusual way, and I hope people will be kind of taken by the way we kind of turn it on its head a bit.
But I think everyone's really hungry to know about the eras back then and what would have gone on in that hotel, even if it what isn't a true story. Is it loosely based on a true story?
It's based on the
story,
the origins of these guys that used to hang out in the gym with
right, okay,
with Don in the last years of his life.
Right. So, you know, like there is that, because we get so many plays from overseas that, and I know 45 Downstairs, I went to one late last year, which was wonderful, but it's nice that there's a local content that we can then relate a little bit more better to, can't we?
Yes. Well, I mean, I was kind of surfing in on that revolution in the late 60s and 70s when we kind of rebelled against the amount of overseas culture that we're actually super saturated with. I mean, all those, you know, John Romerell, David Williamson, Jack Hibbard plays that were written at that period were an assertion that if you don't tell your own stories and you don't listen to them, then reality is something that happens somewhere else.
Yeah.
That you kind of have to have a dialogue with your own history, your own contemporary politics, your own stories.
And the wonderful thing about today is the quality of the actors you would have to have chosen from.
Yes, they're great.
Yeah.
Some of them are recent graduates, but they're led by Charlie Cousins, who maybe your listeners will know from Dr. Blake's murder mysteries, where most of Ballarat seems to be dying off. He plays a character called Charlie in that, supporting Craig McLaughlin.
Yeah.
And his, you know, it's one of the joys of what we do is actually just encountering a whole new generation of practitioners who are theatre makers.
Do you think that they are better these days than they were back, say, 20 years ago, the current actors?
They have much more influences these days. You know,
more training?
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, we hardly you know, studied a play, a read one. You know, I mean, I remember when I was a Christian Brothers boy, tried to mount a production of Summer of the 17th Doll and got all the girls from the nun school down the road. And until a nun actually read it and said, oh my God, this is a play about people living in sin. We can't do this play. You know? But now, you know, their education is...
It's very different.
Very different.
So we're talking about Young and Jackson's, a new play, Old Ways, by Don Reed, as you were saying, 45 Downstairs, and starting soon.
Yes, preview March the 5th.
Right.
Plays through to March 22.
Okay, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
You're a busy man. I would love to have you in again, just to talk more about who you are.
I'd love to.
You're on Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
Well, it is nearly time to say goodbye for another Sunday Arts Magazine.
It goes too quickly.
It does, but, you know, we get so many great interviews here.
Yes, we
really do appreciate people coming in. It is tough on a Sunday to come in and talk about what you're so passionate about.
Yeah.
Now, we did get a message in from Melina before about the Oscars.
Yes.
Can't wait to see Neil Patrick Harris. I should have mentioned him earlier. He's going to be hosting, and I'm sure he's going to be doing a song or two.
I'm sure
on
he
the
will,
stage.
Yeah.
Now, she says he's a great theatre actor.
He is, and obviously wins lots of Tony Awards, and he's made quite a few films as well, so he's not a person that has never been in films.
Well, he was very impressive in Gone Girl. I don't know if you've seen that one, but
yes, I have. He
plays another straight character.
Yep.
It doesn't end very well for him, but he was really good in that role, a bit of a... well, it's a darker film, so it's a kind of a different change of pace for him, I suppose.
Yeah, and then, of course, he's done the Smurf films. And so he's done a little bit of everything, really. So a very good choice, I think, because it's a tough gig, and a lot of people have failed over the years, haven't they?
Well, the Oscars, it's a make-or-break sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, someone like Billy Crystal makes it look pretty easy, but there's been some duds over the years. I think he's going to be great.
Oh, I don't think there will be a problem, and I think the audience will love him as well, because he's such a pro.
I think so, and it's so great that, you know, he's such an openly gay man with a family, and, you know, he's accepted, not just by Hollywood, but by audiences. I just think it's wonderful that we've come that far.
Absolutely, and it's people with that sort of quality that he brings to the stage and to film that makes it worthwhile, and people trust him.
Exactly. Now, before we go, I did want to talk about the White Knight again. It was the Vincent Price unauthorized hagiography, and it was just amazing. If you can sort of find it, either it might be on YouTube or something like that. If you can hunt it down and you love Vincent Price, it's worth it. It's sort of a tongue-in-cheek look at his biography and using clips from his movies as well.
And where was that?
It was at Acme, but it's not a constant thing. It was just for White Knight, so you might have to hunt it down a little bit. Well, thanks again, David.
And thank you, Brendan Michael Bale.
We'll be back next week for another installment of Sunday Arts Magazine.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.